The whole idea of using reusable bags at the grocery store is that it's good for the environment, right? Well, that depends on what bags you use. Recent lab reports in Florida and New York show that some reusable sacks contain elevated levels of lead. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has been talking to shoppers who wonder what they're supposed to do with that news.
In the parking lot of a Wegmans supermarket in Lanham, Maryland, Andrea Harrison is pushing a cart full of Thanksgiving groceries packed in reusable bags. She finds them easier to handle than those flimsy plastic ones. And she has a bigger reason.
It's about trying to keep as many pollutants out of our waterways as we can.
Like many conscientious consumers around the country, Harrison was confronted with a dilemma recently when lots of media outlets reported that the Tampa Tribune had found elevated lead in shopping bags from some Florida supermarkets.
Every week you hear a report about something you think is good turns out to be bad, and something you think is bad turns out to be not so bad, and hopefully one day we'll get it right.
The Florida report followed a study by the Empire State Consumer Project. Judy Brayman says her group sent lots of bags from groceries and other retailers to a laboratory.
And the one that came up very high was a shopping bag from Wegmans supermarket.
19 states have laws that restrict the amount of lead in packaging to one part per million. One Wegmans bag had 9 times that much lead. A second also tested high. Joe Natale, a spokeswoman for Wegmans, says the stores had sold about 100,000 of the offending designs, a holiday pattern, and a close-up of peas in a pod.
Both of these designs are still safe to use. There is no food safety concern. There is no health concern. Disposal is the only concern.
Natale says the store hasn't figured out yet how to dispose of the thousands consumers have returned. So should you worry about your bags?
Oh, I think there's lots of other things out there that you should be more concerned about.
Bruce Hugesteger, a chemist who studied these bags, says he sees little risk of food getting contaminated. The Food and Drug Administration agrees.
FDA doesn't view the reusable grocery bags as a safety hazard.
FDA spokesman Doug Karas says the lab that studied the bags for the Tampa Tribune found lead in the outside decoration, which wouldn't touch food. And besides, Karas says, most food is wrapped in other packaging before it's bagged. Neither the Florida nor the New York Environment Agency has raised concerns about consumers throwing out the bags. And the Federal Environmental Protection Agency says modern landfills protect the environment from hazards like this. Many consumers seem to take the news in stride, but not all.
I'm shocked.
Liz Nixon was heading into Wegmans with her 2 young children and lots of bags.
It seems a bit silly to put anything that's dangerous in a reusable bag that's supposed to be helping the environment, and especially something with, you know, around kids or pets, because my dog certainly gets these and chews on them.
Still, Nixon says she plans to keep using her bags.
But I'm going to go and research it, and I'm not getting lead bags. It's outrageous.
Environmental groups want the lead out, too. But in the meantime, they're urging people not to go back to the old paper or plastic. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, cheering for science. We'll talk about professional cheerleaders doing what they do best to encourage girls to get involved in science. But first, the holiday season is underway and movie studios have begun to flood the multiplexes with flicks they hope will score huge profits, Oscar nominations, or both. One might yearn for plot lines that are new and diverse, but can we say the same about the characters we see on the screen and the folk in the director's chair? Do they reflect the unique backgrounds and cultures of Latino, African, and Asian Americans and other communities of color in the nation? We were curious about the role of diversity in film, particularly Oscar-quality films. So we've called Jeff Yang. He writes the Asian Pop column for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he joins us from our studio in Culver City. Also joining the conversation is Kamal Darsoul. She's editor-in-chief and writer of 3blackchicks.com, a website of film reviews. She joins us from Auburn in Washington State. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The Hollywood Reporter just wrote that for the first time in 10 years, they don't think that there'll be any black nominees in any of the acting categories for the next ceremony. And they're not seeing any people of color among the early list of awards hopefuls. Jeff, if that really happens, what message does that send both to the public and to the Academy?
You know, it looks like we've kind of fallen back into the default, if you will, of having the middle market films and the art films, the films that are generally seen as having the most opportunity to contend for this sort of critical and industry acclaim, if you will, really being absent of representation of people of color.
And when you say people of color, we're talking Asians, we're talking Latinos, not just black folk.
Yeah, and I would actually say that for Asian Americans in general, it's almost kind of a wasteland as far as the Academy Awards are concerned.
Kamal, if the Academy Awards do turn out to be basically all white this year, do you think it sends a particular message to the film industry that that's acceptable, or do you think the message more goes to the public?
I think it goes to the industry that it's more acceptable. I mean, this happens over and over again where they throw us a bone one year and then just take all our toys away the next. I mean, The Color Purple, prime example, nominated for 11 Academy Awards, won 0. You know, as a black woman, the first thing I think about is black actors. But when I broaden my scope, what about all actors of color? We could even say, you know, Arab Americans and Iranian Americans. There's nothing out there to represent and celebrate the citizens of this country who are of color. One of the most disappointing things for me this year was The Last Airbender.
And let me jump in right quick. For people that don't know, in The Last Airbender, there were white people that were playing Asian characters, which caused, shall we say, a bit of controversy.
The one thing that we can be grateful for is that The Last Airbender will be nowhere near the Academy Awards ceremonies next year.
That's true. You know.
Hang on a second. We're going to play a clip from that, and then we're going to come back to it in just a second. Here we go.
You are the only one who can control all the elements and bring peace to our world.
I will stop them.
You may already be too late.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, Jeff, let me ask you, and I have to note, this isn't the first time this director has caught some flack for this, is it?
The director himself, M. Night Shyamalan, who is himself somebody who's been nominated for Academy Awards in the past, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
The Sixth Sense, his kind of opus magnus, put him in contention for a slew of awards, Best Picture, Best
Dead
Director.
People.
Yes. I see dead people, but I don't see Asian people. And, you know, the thing is, he has always seen himself as this sort of solipsistic maverick in Hollywood where, you know, it's his vision that matters most. And I think the real fault has to lie with the studios, because the casting decisions end up being primarily around the idea of avoiding risk as much as possible.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about diversity or the lack of it in the movies, especially those with a chance for Oscar nominations. We're speaking with the San Francisco Chronicle's Asian pop columnist Jeff Yang, and also with editor-in-chief and writer of 3blackchicks.com, Kamal Larsoul. So, if there are talented actors and filmmakers of color, where are they if they're not in the Oscar movies?
You know, this is one of those things where it almost ends up being like, you don't want to blame your own community for this sort of thing. And you can't in some ways. I mean, there are so many talented performers out there who are Asian and African American and Latino. And, you know, and there are filmmakers who are incredibly talented as well. You know, and the question is, okay, well, if so, why aren't they, you know, kind of standing up and being counted? Well, you know, the fact is, it's like with any other profession, you need to have the farm team in place. You need to have people in positions of decision-making power who are saying, you know, I'm going to look at a wider angle, a wider lens on what might be potentially a successful project to put my weight behind. And at every level, you know, from the studio executives to, you know, every step along the way, you just don't have enough people of color inside who can help reach a hand outside to bring in those next generation talents, if you will.
What do you think is going to be the next move, or do you think there'll be a next move from the major film companies on diversity? If all of this ends up to be an all-white Oscars year, do you think there will be another cycle? Because this is beginning to sound like a huge, there's a one big black movie or one movie that has actual Asians or Latinos in it, and there'll be, and then the next 2 years there's nothing.
I think that's what we're looking at, certainly. But there are bigger trends that are happening, and I think the biggest of these trends is that we are looking at more and more films being made for global audiences and for global consumption. I'm actually here in Los Angeles right now on the press tour for a film that's coming out called The Warrior's Way, which is an international production. It stars a superstar in Korea, a guy named Jang Dong-gun. Alongside him is Kate Bosworth, Danny Houston, and Academy Award-nominated actor Jeffrey Rush. So you have this desire here, I think, for more people to say, we're not going to play the straight Hollywood game now. You know, we're going to put our money, and this is not a small-budget film. It's, you know, nicely budgeted film. And we're going to see whether or not we can't get butts in seats on both sides of the Pacific.
Kamal, from your point of view, do you see color on the horizon?
It'll be a whitewashed Oscar, and we will stand up and protest and yell and scream and bring the spotlight back on people of color. And so the Oscars of 2012 will probably have a nice array of people of color, and then we'll go back into the commonplace and get comfortable again until we have to scream. And I just wish we would get to a day where we don't have to scream.
Kamal Larsoul is the editor-in-chief and writer of 3blackchicks.com. She joined us from Auburn, a town in Washington State. Jeff Yang writes the Asian pop column for the San Francisco Chronicle. He joined us from our studio in Culver City. Thank you both for an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne, and today is a day I could have gone shopping for sales on my way to work in the dark. It's called Black Friday because many retailers rely on this day to lift them out of the red. Holiday shoppers can snag some mighty big bargains if they're willing to wait in line. And this year, they can strategize with the help of specials that have been leaked on the internet. NPR's Carrie Kahn has this roundup.
Karen Ann Parkinson is in line this morning, bright and early, at her local Target store in Redondo Beach, California. The sixth grade teacher is looking for the latest Xbox video game, Halo Reach. But it's not for one of her four children.
It's actually for me. Shh, don't tell anybody. Is that bad that I'm Christmas shopping for myself?
Parkinson says she loves the crowds and excitement of today, but she admits she slowed down a bit. This year was nothing like what she had to do during the Beanie Baby craze of the 1990s.
If they would open at 6 a.m., you know, you'd be there at 3 or 2, lining up around the block. It was insane. My mother and I were a little addictive with the collecting of the Beanie Babies, so we had just hundreds of Beanie Babies by the end.
And she didn't pour through the newspaper for Black Friday ads this year either. She used the computer and was able to plan out today's budget and strategy a week ago.
So this is gotadeal.com, and so it has all the stores listed that you could possibly want to shop on.
So this is the first time you've ever used this?
Yes. It's much faster than it used to be just getting the newspaper.
Parkinson could have started planning in September. That's when some sites got their hands on retailers' Black Friday ads. GotADeal.com's Dev Shapiro says he gets his leaks from the guy in the mailroom.
He'll take the ad into the bathroom and take pictures of it and then send it to us. Or it's the guy at the printing press who happens to get a copy of it, take it home, scan it into the computer, and send it to us.
Shapiro also gets an annual cease and desist letter from big retailers like Walmart and Home Depot.
It wouldn't be Black Friday without the Walmart legal threats.
So he waits until he gets the green light before posting Walmart specials. He says this year there are plenty of deals, especially on big-screen TVs and small electronics like e-readers. Shapiro's been camped out in front of the Best Buy in Plano, Texas, since yesterday.
We rent a porta-potty, and that's a big joke with everybody, and we know people in line.
There may be as many as 138 million shoppers in lines and stores today, according to a survey by the National Retail Federation. And Allison Paul with the accounting firm Deloitte says it looks like holiday spending will be up about 2% this year. Not great, but a big improvement over recent years when Paul says there was nowhere to go but up.
It's kind of like you can't fall off the floor. But that's good news for retailers because what it signals is, you know, the end of the downturn and the end of this sort of puritanical approach to the holidays.
Paul says retailers who've taken full advantage of social networking are going to do better this year. Best Buy, for the first time, has holiday marketing on Facebook, Twitter, and two smartphone apps. VP Sherry Ballard says this could be the best Black Friday in years.
We're extraordinarily excited about it. I think there's probably a lot of pent-up consumer demand.
Ballard says she's not worried that all the leaks and online bargains are taking the fun out of Black Friday. Shopping devotee Karen Parkinson says she wouldn't trade going out in the crowds for anything. It's a holiday tradition, a challenge.
Definitely an element of Black Friday is the game of getting it first and being able to get one of the limited number of items, you know.
And she says watch out, that discounted Halo Reach video game at Target, it's hers. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This next story is about a child with autism and his father, a scientist. Not just any scientist, but one with expertise to study his own son's condition and perhaps improve it. But there's a catch. The scientist's research has primarily benefited another child. Independent producer Mary Beth Kirchner profiles one man's journey pushing the limits of scientific research and parental devotion.
It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and a mini yellow school bus has stopped at the home of Barry and Renee Gordon in suburban Baltimore.
Hi, Alex.
Their son Alex has just arrived, and his babysitter Celinda is waiting at the curb.
I'm at school.
Alex is autistic, severely autistic, and has never spoken a word.
Did you have a good day?
But the sound of his voice carries up to the birds in the trees while he runs and stops up the long driveway, his backpack dragging behind. Alex is 14 and has just returned from a full day at his special needs school. His late afternoon routine begins with a kiss for his mom.
Oh, thank you. Did you have a good day at school?
A quick snack in front of the TV, and then more therapy at home.
There's a variety of tasks to try to help expand his cognitive skills and his
Alex's father, Dr. Barry Gordon, is a neurologist and an experimental psychologist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Gordon has spent much of his career studying memory and how human beings develop language, but he never imagined his life's work would become so personal.
Can I get a kissy? See, he gives me his forehead to kiss.
That's his kiss.
That's his kiss.
His son, Alex, was diagnosed as autistic at the age of 4.
He couldn't do anything a normal child did. He was in a preschool, and he couldn't even go ring around the rosy. He couldn't seemingly understand or even pay attention to a word that anybody said. And at some point, I got pretty frustrated.
Gordon knew, as both a doctor and a parent, he should leave his son's care to the professionals. But there was little research about nonverbal autistic children.
And so I wrote up a grant proposal to look at speech perception. I tried peddling it to private sources and talked myself hoarse and never got anywhere.
Not long after, Gordon was invited to be part of a conference for prospective donors, where he was asked to talk about memory and learning. After his lecture, he was at a table where the guests started informally sharing stories about their children, and Gordon mentioned to the person sitting next to him that his youngest son was autistic, and that dinner companion said,
"Your youngest son sounds a lot like my partner's son. He's over there. I dragged him to this meeting. He hasn't given any money to this group. Why don't you go talk to him?"
Gordon walked over to say hello, and his work was forever changed. That person across the room had the resources to personally fund Gordon's research. His real question was, do you think your son or mine could ever learn to talk?
You know, my PhD's in psycholinguistics. I'm a behavioral neurologist. I had a son who couldn't speak, couldn't learn. I'd worked in memory. If I didn't do it, who would?
Since then, it's been a decade-long journey trying to answer that question.
The typical rules of thumb that parents had been told was, if a child didn't speak by age 5, it was very unlikely that they were going to speak at all.
Do this.
His patron's child was 8 when research started. Gordon predicted there might be a 5% chance for some improvement. Under Gordon's direction and the careful watch of the father and mother, therapists tried many approaches like pushing the child's lips together and shaping his mouth to help him form letters. The real opportunity came when Gordon's patrons made him this proposition.
If you could design what you would consider to be the perfect program, would you do it? And they basically said, money should not be a consideration.
What's that?
If you had your druthers, you'd do it for your own children, too. After all, if you had your druthers, you'd hire Aristotle to train your son Alexander, the great. Bring in the great teachers and have them come to your child.
Thanks for telling me you're finished, buddy.
Gordon created the dream program for his patron son. 50 hours a week with a staff of 5 top teachers and therapists, including activities like skiing and horseback riding and music. But for much of the day, their focus was speech.
Try again. D. That's saying candy.
Therapists spent years helping him say consonants, then consonant and vowel combinations. 8 years after Gordon began this research, the child said his first recognizable words at the age of 16.
Somebody you live with is...
Mom,
that's right. Someone else you live with is...
Daddy.
Nice, what a guy. Who's the man?
Me.
You're right. That's
what happened after then has been amazing to me.
Can you say, I want candy?
I want candy.
Now, it's amazing to me, if your perspective is a normally speaking child who can speak 130 words a minute and has a vocabulary when they're a teenager of, say, 60,000 words, it may not be that impressive. But he can speak, we think, about 100 words by imitation and can say spontaneously on his own about 20 words in a recognizable way.
I want music.
Nice job asking for music. You have to turn it
on.
Gordon says the scientific literature shows no record of a child with autism who had developed speech at such a late age. But for the patron's family, it took on a whole different meaning.
His grandmother passed away, and he and his father went to the coffin. And the son said, bye. And they had never imagined he'd be able to do that.
What's happened with Alex while all this has been going on?
Alex couldn't be in a full-time program. That was far beyond our capabilities. When I tallied up the time and effort, it was not even within reach.
Gordon said the program was so costly, it wasn't even remotely affordable for his own son, Alex. Yet Gordon and his wife, Renee, had designed a program for Alex that was extraordinary in its own right. Alex went to a school for autistic children at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore and had 4 part-time therapists at home.
Alex, tell me, I don't want that.
Alex uses a communication device where he pushes buttons with images and words to communicate his thoughts.
I don't want that. Great job, Alex.
But Gordon says he and his wife frequently have dreams where their son can talk, too.
Sometimes we call them nightmares, in which something like that happens. They're nightmares because we wake up from them and realize, again, he's not talking.
Help.
We had internal debate that I'll let my wife describe about what we should be working on with him.
5 minutes.
The debate between Barry and Renee Gordon came down to moments like these.
Light off, please.
Renee says Alex still needs help with simple tasks of everyday living, sorting his clothes and dressing himself, even putting on his socks.
Let's try your hands.
His learning these skills was far more important to her than speech.
He doesn't understand concepts of happy, sad, pain. And that's when I think that the communication is most important. And because I don't believe that even if you do get them to speak, you can have a meaningful system of communication, I've just taken a what I consider to be a pragmatic approach.
Very good.
Going out for dinner is part of developing Alex's life skills. To wait for a table and order a meal.
Do you want to eat a hot dog?
We're at a TGI Fridays not far from their home, where Alex and Barry and Renee have been many times. But something tonight is bothering Alex.
Everything is okay.
Perhaps it's the baby across the room that's crying. Perhaps it's a new person like me at the table.
Can you give me your hand? Everything is okay.
Well, this is one reason communication is important, if we can only figure out what it is. Yeah, nothing bad.
Meantime, there's certainly no guarantee that Gordon's patron son would have the words either for moments like these. Gordon makes it clear that his patron's child communicates with very limited speech, not language and complex ideas.
Does it ever seem unfair that it wasn't your son who was the first one to have the words?
Well, you know, just thinking about it, I feel I'm a little tearful about it. But, you know, there has to be somebody who's first. And actually, in medical research, often you don't want to be the very first. You want to be like the 10th in line. But, you know, this young man, his family, and all that we've been able to accomplish, I think serve as kind of a beacon out there that it can happen.
Say video.
D-D-O. But if the costs were prohibitively expensive for Gordon himself, how could it ever be affordable for anyone else?
The first doses of penicillin were beyond expensive. In fact, they were hardly available, so that when the first doses were used up, there was no more. So you might imagine their cost was infinite at that point. We now know penicillin is pennies. Progress of science and technology and of management can make things more efficient. What we need to know is that it's possible for them to be achieved at all. Once you know that it's possible, then you can work on making it better. I just gave Alex a new keyboard he's playing with.
It's now been 4 years since these recordings were made, and Gordon's son, Alex, is now 18. He's playing music, has learned to dress himself with some help, and has been to a sleepaway camp. The patron's son is now 22 and is still in Barry Gordon's full-time program, which has grown to a staff of 10. He is now able to speak more words, up to 7 in a row. Gordon recently presented his findings to a panel on nonverbal children at the National Institutes of Health. His next task is to apply this research to other subjects.
In science, one case may be suggestive, but it's very far from proof. An ultimate goal would be to try to take it to a group of individuals where it could be better controlled and better implemented, to actually test it, to see whether it truly is efficacious and it's not just a lucky combination of circumstances. Oh, yes, tomorrow is the state fair. We're going to see the piggies and the sheepies and the horses.
And finally, as a father and a scientist, Barry Gordon says he still hasn't given up hope that his own son might have speech someday, too.
Can you show me? I want to go.
I want to go.
Yeah, there's no fare on here. Yeah. Okay. I'll have to work on that.
Mary Beth Kirchner is an independent producer in Los Angeles. Our story was produced with help from American Radio Works. The world is changing for commentator Andrei Kudrescu. He finds evidence of this change in a new gospel, a gospel of digital friendship.
A man with many friends is rich and blessed, saith the good books. But a man with many friends on Facebook is cursed, saith Facebook, who sets the limit of a man's friends at 5,000. And those who dare ask a man with more than 5,000 friends to be a friend will be mightily rebuked by Facebook, claiming on that man's behalf that he already hadeth too many friends, and no more will be allowed. So speak at Facebook, the ordinator of friends. And those who dare ask for friendship after the 5,000 have taken their places in the pews and aisles of friendship must become fans and stand outside with palm fronds moving in their hands to cool the man's body from the rigors of friendship. Now let the truth be known that Facebook has decreed 5,000 to be no more than a crowd on a Saturday night, more than a party, but less than a legion. Because Facebook fears rebellion, though it encourages commerce. And there will rise in the land an army called the Body Book, and it will wipe that grin off the face of Facebook, and they will be myriads, 5,000 by 5,000, and they will be like leaves of grass to the ledgers of accountants. And this will happen on 1/11/11. So saith this prisoner of the decrees of Facebook, the stingiest landlord in Cyberlandia.
commentator Andrei Kudrescu. His latest book is The Poetry Lesson, and since you're wondering, yes, he has 4,995 friends on Facebook.
Micro-lending, making small loans to the poor, has been much talked about. Micro-savings is a newer idea. That's because poor people in the developing world often have a hard time putting money aside. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation wants to change that, and it's putting $500 million towards the effort. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
It's pretty intuitive to think the poor in Africa or India might need to borrow money. But it turns out that far, far more poor people want to save money.
The poor do save. They already save.
That's Melinda Gates speaking at a recent forum on global savings.
We're unlocking something they do. So if you go talk to poor people, they know. I mean, they have incredible asset management, most of them.
They might buy livestock or jewelry they can sell when they need cash. But animals die and a necklace can get stolen. Commercial banks in the developing world have shown little interest in providing the poor with financial services. Believing a new approach was needed, a few people have begun to innovate on the savings front. Bill and Melinda Gates started to pay attention.
It really is all about how do you create something at scale that will help people transform their own lives.
We went into a market and they established a kiosk in that market out of a butcher's shop.
Alexander Kalanda heads the Opportunity International Bank of Malawi. He says initially shoppers were suspicious of his mini bank and mainstream bankers laughed. But today, 12,000 people save money at that one site alone.
Virtually everybody in that market is banking with us.
And so are people in the neighborhood. Many deposit 75 cents at a time, and their average balance is less than $85. But add it all up, and you get to $1 million. Because the bank's customer base across Malawi is large and the bank's transaction costs low, it can make a profit. Another model is in Kenya, where M-Pesa allows people to use mobile phones to transfer and save money without opening an actual bank account. The Gates Foundation funds will go to expanding programs like these, promoting new ideas and studying what works. Saving by itself isn't enough, says Gates. She wants to know, does the money put aside actually improve lives? For example, does it allow the poor to expand their harvest? Early results from Malawi and elsewhere, she says, are encouraging.
The change that we have seen in this field in the last 3 years is astounding. And I think the change, if we sat here and talked about it 3 years hence, is going to be quite phenomenal, both in terms of the number of poor being banked and how their lives are changing.
Many experts in global poverty applaud the foundation's push into micro savings. One of them is Yale economics professor Dean Carlin. But he cautions that you don't want the poor to be saving money at the same time they're borrowing it at very high interest rates. And he says,
the last thing we want to do is let micro savings become the next microcredit, where its advocates pretend like it is the panacea against poverty, that it's the silver bullet.
Rather, he suggests micro saving is just one step in solving the very complex problem of global poverty. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.